听力课堂，听 class.com。
Unit 7, Section A. China has announced its plans to launch its first manned spacecraft in the second half of this year, to become only the third country to do so. The news comes as China's first unmanned space capsule orbits the Earth.Chinese state media Thursday quote a senior aerospace official, Yang Jie, as saying that the Shenzhou 5 capsule will send a human being into space before the end of this year. Mr. Yuan made his announcement upon his return from the launch of the unmanned Shenzhou 4 spacecraft. State television carried footage of the space vehicle taking off Monday from a launch pad in the Gobi Desert.The Shenzhou 4 capsule is now circling the Earth once every 90 minutes, carrying all the systems needed for manned flight. The mission is expected to last 7 days and will test life support capabilities in space, among other things. Chinese President Jiang Zemin calls the latest rocket launch a great victory and is urging all involved in the space program to redouble our efforts and work in a pioneering spirit to contribute more to the peaceful development of outer space.Mr. Jiang's comments indicate the importance Beijing attaches to its secretive space program. China views its space launches, which are not announced in advance, as symbols of national pride and greatness. The Shenzhou 4 capsule is the second launched in a year. China launched its first unmanned Shenzhou spacecraft, whose name means Divine Ship, in 1999.If successful, the planned manned flight would make China the third country,behind only Russia and the United States, to send people into space.
Section B. 1. You're planning to take 2 extra courses next term. You must be out of your mind.
2. What this building needs is better soundproofing. I simply can't concentrate.
3.You want me to pay $300 for the trip to Florida? Do you think I just inherited a fortune?
4. Being a house painter is hard work, but I get to be outdoors and the pay is decent.
5. If you want to add that information to your paper, you really should check it out first.
It was very kind of Miss Janet to meet us at the airport, especially at such short notice.
7. She used to take 2 tablets a day, but recently the doctor doubled the dosage.
8. The forecast is for a severe winter, so I'm waiting for the next sale to get a down jacket.
9. John is going to California to take up a research position, and I need to find a new roommate.
10. The football game started at 2 o'clock, and we arrived just in time for the second half.
2. The newest U.S. spacecraft to orbit Mars, the Odyssey,have discovered vast amounts of water on the red planet during its first week of observations. The discovery supports the notion that life might have existed there at one time. The Mars Odyssey, launched last April, has detected what scientists believe is a large amount of water in the form of ice at the Martian South Pole, covering a surface area more than 600 kilometers across. Scientists have long known of the presence of water on Mars,But University of Arizona astronomer William Boynton says the new results go beyond the volume expected. The signal that we've been getting loudly and clearly is that there is a lot of ice on Mars. We've seen really a lot of ice in the southern hemisphere, all the way from the South Pole on up to about 60 degrees latitude, Mr. Boynton explains. Mr. Boynton has said further observations are required to determine the precise extent of the ice. but he suggests it amounts to a significant percentage of the planet's surface, mostly mixed in with the top meter of soil. We really are excited about seeing that, he says. U.S. Space Agency Odyssey Project scientist Stephen Saunders explains why all the excitement. Water is vital to life. Water has changed the face of Mars in the past, and water is necessary for the future exploration of Mars, he says. The spacecraft detected the Martian water indirectly by sensing significant amounts of hydrogen, a component of water. William Boynton says his team judged it to be hydrogen-based on the characteristic intensity and wavelength of gamma rays emitted from it when displaced by the natural bombardment of atomic particles called neutrons.
B. According to a recent report, water has been discovered on Mars. Mr. Boynton, an astronomer, explains, "One of the reasons we feel very comfortable coming up with this conclusion, even after looking at the data for only about a week, because we've also seen it by other instruments as well. The U.S. spacecraft's Odyssey's camera system is also studying Mars' surface minerals to reveal the red planet's geologic history." Arizona State University astronomer Philip Christensen says an infrared camera is measuring differences in heat emissions between soil and rocks, helping map the composition of the terrain, 30 times sharper than instruments on previous spacecraft at Mars. This will tell us a great deal about the physical state of Mars, where rocks are, where erosion has occurred. We can't see these rocks, but we know they are there from their temperature signature. It truly provides a whole new way of looking at the planet. Other measurements made as Odyssey was en route to Mars suggested that the daily dose of radiation astronauts would get on a voyage there would be more than twice the amount experienced aboard the International Space Station. A subsequent failure of the instrument to communicate has foiled efforts to measure radiation hitting Mars' surface.
C. In science, a theory is a reasonable explanation of observed events that are related. A theory often involves an imaginary model that helps scientists picture the way an observed event could be produced. A good example of this is found in the kinetic molecular theory, in which gases are pictured as being made up of many small particles that are in constant motion. A useful theory, in addition to explaining past observations, helps to predict events that have not as yet been observed. After a theory has been publicized, scientists design experiments to test the theory. If observations confirm the scientists' predictions, the theory is supported. If observations do not confirm the predictions, the scientists must search further. There may be a fault in the experiment, or the theory may have to be revised or rejected. Science involves imagination and creative thinking as well as collecting information and performing experiments. Facts by themselves are not science. As the mathematician Jules-Henri Poincaré said, "Science is built with facts, just as a house is built with bricks. But a collection of facts cannot be called science any more than a pile of bricks can be called a house." Most scientists start an investigation by finding out what other scientists have learned about a particular problem. After known facts have been gathered, the scientist comes to the part of the investigation that requires considerable imagination. Possible solutions to the problem are formulated. These possible solutions are called hypotheses. In a way, any hypothesis is a leap into the unknown. It extends the scientist's thinking beyond the known facts. The scientist plans experiments, performs calculations, and makes observations to test hypotheses. Without hypothesis, further investigation lacks purpose and direction. When hypotheses are confirmed, they are incorporated into theories.
D. U.S. scientists have good news about the Earth's protective ozone layer. They report that its destruction in the upper atmosphere is slowing, and the amount of industrial pollutants doing the destruction is going down. The findings show that a 16-year-old global ban on those pollutants is effective. The industrial pollutants in question are the hard-to-pronounce chlorine compounds called chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs for short. CFCs were once common as refrigerants and aerosol propellants. Nearly 30 years ago, scientists learned they destroy the ozone layer that blocks harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun. An increasing amount of this radiation reaching the ground has been linked to increased incidence of skin cancer and cataracts of the eye. As a result, a 1987 international treaty called the Montreal Protocol and subsequent amendments phased out production of CFCs by 1996 and other ozone-depleting chemicals by 2000. By the mid-1990s, researchers first noticed a drop in CFCs in the lower atmosphere where we live and breathe. Scientists now report that the compounds are declining much higher in the atmosphere, in the upper stratosphere, the topmost ozone layer far above where airplanes fly. At the same time, the rate of ozone destruction there is also declining. There is compelling evidence from global satellite observations that the Montreal Protocol is working. The ozone layer is in its first stage of recovery in the upper stratosphere. However, full recovery is still decades away, on the order of 4 to 6 decades, about 50 years. Ozone is probably beginning to recover in the lower stratospheric layer, but observations cannot yet prove this because the amount of ozone varies too much from year to year to note a trend. But according to scientists, the Montreal Protocol banning CFCs was necessary, despite its limited atmospheric result. The scientific community knew that the protocol would not solve the problem, but it was a very important first international geopolitical step to take.
Section D. The Earth's moon, which has always been an object of worship and mystery to people of all cultures and religions, is located an average of 239,000 miles from the Earth. It has a diameter of 2,136 miles, and its gravity is one-sixth that of Earth's. Scientists know that the moon, as well as the sun, affects the ocean's tides. It is also possible that the moon is related to the occurrence of earthquakes. But today we are going to discuss another fascinating question with respect to the moon. Does it affect our behavior? To begin with, many observers say that the moon's phases definitely affect the behavior of animals. For example, fishermen know that fish are easier or harder to catch, depending on what stage the moon is in. But what about people? Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer, says, "I have no doubt the moon has an effect on human behavior. There are stories in almost every society about people who do strange and unpredictable things during the time of the full moon, which comes approximately every 29 days. Is there really a connection?" Well, one person who believes that the answer to this question is yes is Dr. Arnold Lieber, a psychiatrist in Miami. He has written a book called The Lunar Effect, in which he points out that crime rates seem to increase at the time of the full moon. For example, a woman named Sarah Jane Moore tried to kill former President Gerald Ford during a full moon. Patricia Hearst, the famous heiress, was also kidnapped by a group of terrorists at this time. Dr. Lieber also believes that the full moon is linked to depression in many people. In fact, he points out that in 1977, 9 people committed suicide by jumping off San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge during full moons. In Los Angeles, some members of the police and fire departments agree that the full moon is associated with more crime and unusual behavior. According to the fire department, the highest number of car accidents occurs on 2 occasions, when welfare checks are distributed and when the moon is full. A Los Angeles police sergeant named Bob Kenny is convinced that the full moon has some effects on people, though he agrees that this is very hard to prove. Still, according to the Los Angeles Times of January 20, 1984, he says that most of the police officers he knows believe there is a connection between crime rates and the full moon. Many airline pilots, waitresses, bartenders, and newspaper reporters, all of whom deal directly with the public, agree that people behave oddly during periods of the full moon, though they can't specify exactly how or why it happens. But of course, there are also plenty of people who disagree. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Dwayne Rasher says that people can behave oddly at any time. He says his workload is no heavier during the full moon. Bar owner Jim Foley agrees with Rasher. People can be erratic at any time, he says. You might want to check the calendar and find out when the full moon will occur in the next few months. During those times, observe the behavior of your family and friends and see if they do anything that is unexplainable or unusual. In the meantime, if it turns out that the moon really does make us all act strangely, let's be thankful that we live on Earth with its one moon and not on Saturn, which has 22 moons, or Jupiter, which has 4 major moons and 12 minor ones.
Unit 8. Section A. The United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund estimates 1 billion children, almost half the children in the world, live in urban areas. According to a report by the Children's Agency, as cities grow larger, so do the problems children living in cities have to endure. The UNICEF report says more than 80% of the 1 billion children who live in cities live in megacities in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. UNICEF spokesman Patrick McCormick says the children in these large cities are the most vulnerable to various forms of exploitation, from child labor to prostitution. They are so poor, Mr. McCormick says, they are often willing to do anything to survive. It is a pretty ferocious environment when you are down on the bottom to fight for the scraps that come your way. There is a huge temptation to go into the criminal world. You can see that all over the world, especially in developing countries, children who are reduced to begging or stealing or doing jobs like washing windscreens or handing out newspapers or whatever it is. These are not sustainable occupations. The UNICEF report notes that during the last century, the world's urban population grew more than tenfold. As the cities have grown bigger, health conditions have often become worse. In some cities in developing countries, the report says, child mortality rates are as high as 100 to 200 per 1,000 live births, and many children suffer from anemia and malnutrition. However, UNICEF says there is some room for optimism. The report points out that some cities around the world are taking steps to make their environments safer and healthier for children. It says, in Calcutta, India's second largest city, as many as 42 police stations are involved in activities to protect children at risk, especially street children. Another child-friendly project is underway in the Dominican Republic. The study says 14 cities in the Caribbean country are working with UNICEF to create parks where children can play safely.
Section B. 1. In spite of occasional differences in opinion, Ron and Paul get along very well.
2. Seafood prices had come down quite a bit, so I bought 3 pounds of shrimps at $2 per pound.
3. This shop has got some inexpensive prints that would make good adornments if you're a modern art lover.
4. Gary plans to finish his thesis this month, and he'll be too busy for parties.
5. Mary ordinarily has lunch with her husband, but today he's out of town on business.
6. I'm afraid I can't help you with your economics assignment. It's over my head.
7. We were stuck in a traffic jam, so it took 3 hours longer than usual to get to the office.
8. He was coughing all night. The sooner he stops smoking, the better he'll feel.
9. The sales representative had trouble getting his checks cashed.
10. In the report submitted to the State Council, the economists underestimated the rate of inflation. Section C. A. In the United States, homelessness had grown at a dramatic rate during the last decades. Estimates of the number of Americans currently without a permanent home vary widely. Advocacy groups like the National Coalition for the Homeless say that close to 3 million Americans live on the streets or in emergency and temporary shelters. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development puts the figure at 350,000. Yet both bureaucrats and advocates agree on one point, that is, the nature of homelessness has changed radically in the past 10 years, as more and more low-income housing is mowed down in the name of progress. Some 20 years ago, says Kristen Morris, assistant director of the New York Office of the National Coalition for the Homeless, the typical street person was a white male who suffered from a mental illness or an addiction to drugs or alcohol. Today's homeless, however, are a more eclectic group. More than 60% of the homeless today are black, mostly single mothers with small children. More than half of them have never been homeless before. In many cases, they have been evicted from their homes, or the low-income housing in which they lived was demolished or burned down. About 60% of all homeless people live on some form of public assistance, with an average monthly income of $210. About 20% are mentally ill. According to Marie Robinson, who is a lawyer for the Coalition for the Homeless, there has been a real democratization of Skid Row. All sorts of people have been pushed out of the housing market because of the critical shortage of affordable places to live.
B. In America today, homelessness has climbed to the top of the new generation's short list of social concerns. But there is a great gap between concern and active involvement in the effort to solve this growing problem. For many people, the inaction is due to ignorance, not indifference. According to Ellen Rocks, who is executive director of the House of Ruth, an organization that provides shelter and other services to women who are homeless or are the victims of domestic violence, there are a lot of people who want to get involved but don't really know how. The fact is that there are many ways in which individuals can help the homeless. Yet for those people truly interested in the cause, one of the first steps is to get to know the homeless and understand how they became that way. Many advocates believe that it is important for middle-class people to get to know and reach out to the homeless and bridge the gap that exists. Middle-class people have to learn that what is happening in America today is an all-out war on the poor. Just as Americans once robbed the Indians of their land, today we're robbing the poor of affordable housing.
See. If by suburb is meant an urban margin that grows more rapidly than its already developed interior, the process of suburbanization began during the emergence of the industrial city in the second quarter of the 19th century. Before that period, the city was a small, highly compact cluster in which people moved about on foot and goods were conveyed by horse and cart. But the early factories built in the 1840s were located along waterways and near railheads at the edges of the cities, and housing was needed for the thousands of people drawn by the prospect of employment. In time, the factories were surrounded by proliferating mill towns of apartments and warehouses that abutted the older main cities. As a defense against this encroachment and to enlarge their tax bases, the cities appropriated their industrial neighbors. In 1854, for example, the city of Philadelphia annexed most of Philadelphia County. Similar municipal maneuvers took place in Chicago and in New York. Indeed, most great cities of the United States achieved such status only by incorporating the communities along their borders. With the acceleration of industrial growth came acute urban crowding and accompanying social stress, conditions that began to approach disastrous proportions when, in 1888, the first commercially successful electric traction line was developed. Within a few years, the horse-drawn trolleys were retired, and electric streetcar networks crisscrossed and connected every major urban area, fostering a wave of suburbanization that transformed the compact industrial city into a dispersed metropolis. This first phase of mass-scale suburbanization was reinforced by the simultaneous emergence of the urban middle class, whose desires for home ownership in neighborhoods far from the aging inner city were satisfied by the developers of single-family housing tracts.
D. In the late 1960s, many people in North America turned their attention to environmental problems, and new steel and glass skyscrapers were widely criticized. Ecologists pointed out that a cluster of tall buildings in a city often overburdens public transportation and parking lot capacities. Skyscrapers are also lavish consumers and wasters of electric power. In one recent year, the addition of 17 million square feet of skyscraper office space in New York City raised the peak daily demand for electricity by 120,000 kilowatts, enough to supply the entire city of Albany, New York, for a day. Glass-walled skyscrapers can be especially wasteful. The heat loss, or gain, through a wall of half-inch plate glass is more than 10 times that through a typical masonry wall filled with insulation board. To lessen the strain on heating and air conditioning equipment, builders of skyscrapers have begun to use double-glazed panels of glass and reflective glasses coated with silver or gold mirror films that reduce glare as well as heat gain. However, mirror-walled skyscrapers raise the temperature of the surrounding air and affect neighboring buildings. Skyscrapers put a severe strain on a city's sanitation facilities, too. If fully occupied, the two World Trade Center towers in New York City would alone generate 2.25 million gallons of raw sewage each year, as much as a city the size of Stamford, Connecticut, which has a population of more than 109,000.
Section D. The United Nations has begun moving thousands of homeless people out of Liberia's overcrowded capital, Monrovia, to camps on the outskirts of the city. At least 300,000 people from rural areas flooded into Monrovia in June, seeking refuge from fighting between government troops and rebels. Tens of thousands of them are crammed into small buildings, such as schools and clinics. A spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency, Delphine Marie, describes the conditions under which these people are living as miserable. There is no proper hygiene structures, not enough latrines in those places. There is development of various diseases. There has been a wide cholera epidemic in Monrovia. That is also due to the unavailability of potable water and of sufficient hygiene structures. Miss Marie says these homeless people will be much better off once they are moved to the camps outside Monrovia. She says it will be much easier for humanitarian agencies to organize the distribution of goods in these designated areas. Because it has been so difficult to provide assistance to displaced people in Monrovia, many have gone hungry, and the sick have gone unattended. But Miss Marie says most basic services will be provided in the camps, and life for the displaced should be improved. That they have enough latrines, that there is water, there is a clinic or health services available to them in the camps. We will also provide some new shelter equipment where it is needed, and we will resume distribution of blankets, mats, buckets, jerry cans, other items, as well as food distribution by the World Food Programme in these areas. Miss Marie says her agency has worked very closely with the West African peacekeepers to improve the security in and around the camps. She says patrols are taking place three times a day among the different camps, and checkpoints are set up in several locations. The United Nations hopes to move 30,000 displaced people, now living in 56 schools in Monrovia, into the camps by October the 20th. That will free up the classrooms for the start of the school year.